Today is Wednesday. It's September 29th, 2021. And it's 1:38 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams, and thanks for finding the Missing Rascals podcast. You can listen for me on WGN Radio weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Heather Sharone from WTTW News.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Brandon Pilt from WCIU and Ebony Magazine.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the veteran publisher of the Picayune Sentinel newsletter.
How's that going, Eric? Have you been kind of keeping us posted on that? Lots of subscribers still?
Yeah, it's going really well. Thanks. My fourth issue will come out tomorrow, and I've heard from quite a few Mincing Rascals listeners who want me to add them to the list. So just ericzorn@gmail.com. I'll put you on the list, and I'll send it out to you every Thursday morning.
Eric is still writing and cracking wise online now, so you can subscribe to that. By the way, there are 30 seats left at the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove for our October 30th podcast recording. That's about 970 seats sold. Thomas Jefferson will go on to stage afterwards. Austin Berg is still going to go to a wedding. That's still on. You're not...
The wedding's on. I'll keep you guys up to the minute updates on the wedding.
Maybe you could zoom in from the wedding. Is that possible?
Yeah, I'm sure my friend wouldn't care at all if I was on a phone at her wedding doing a live podcast.
I was talking to a friend this week, by the way, about how when the pandemic first hit, we all Zoomed. It was like everybody was meeting on Zoom, socially even. Like Brenda and I would get a cocktail in our hands and go sit in front of our computer. And we never did this. Then we'd visit with the Caraffas and the Petersons. We don't do that anymore. We're done with it. You know what I mean? Do you guys still Zoom socially or no? We're in phase five, right?
Yeah, Zoom happy hours are dead. I was done with them like by the third one I did. I was like, all right, this is...
We haven't done them in a while, but I can easily see going back to them if the winter closes in and people don't feel safe being indoors. I've really enjoyed seeing people, but everyone we've had over, we've entertained on the back deck or on the back patio. And I can really see it happening again this coming winter. So I'm not closed off to it.
Boy, it'll be so lousy. Mark Baser, who's guested with us here before, was the one that brought that up to me. And we're like, you know what? We'll just let our friendships go.
Just end them.
Yeah. All right. So today we have a looming financial collapse in Washington, D.C., and a pandemic that refuses to abate. We've got cats and dogs living together. But all of Chicago today is squirming over the possible relocation of their storied Chicago Bears. The monsters of the suburbs will be playing almost certainly at a site occupied by the Arlington Park racetrack. Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who dismissed this possibility earlier this year as a negotiating tactic, now says she'll do everything to keep the team by the lake. No one believes that, of course. And besides, it looks like the horse is out of the barn, if you will. Today, our prickly mayor said that she won't let them out early of their lease agreement. It's a cost the Bears can't afford. The question is now, when will this happen and the team play in Arlington Heights? Our Mark Carman tweeted, since they're only moving 1.1 yards at a time right now, it's going to take a while for them to get there. Brandon, you go first. What's your take on this? Is this good for the team and the city?
It's great for both, honestly. I think this is a great thing. I've warmed up to the idea more and more. Arlington Heights, look at what the Rams did in L.A., okay? The L.A. Rams knew they had to do something and get a new stadium. They went out, built up SoFi Stadium. Now they are one of the most valuable franchises in sports that quickly. The Bears can do the same thing. It's projected that if they do make this move, they would be the most lucrative franchise in the NFL. You'd have the sports betting there. You'd have restaurants. You'd have bars. It's great for Arlington Heights. It'll raise property values and things like that. But Chicago, Soldier Field is still going to be there, and it's going to be used. It's going to be a dome. WrestleMania needs a dome. The Chicago Fire, they need a dome. College football teams are going to want to come through. The Soldier Field series is probably going to continue. A college bowl game, and then down the line, 2030, by the time this new stadium gets built, the NFL might be looking to expand to 34 NFL teams, 36. Maybe we have an expansion team. Maybe Chicago has two NFL teams. The possibilities are endless.
You're saying they're going to put a dome on Soldier Field?
At this point, many places need a dome. You might as well dome Soldier Field. Arlington Heights will probably be retractable. Might as well put a dome on Soldier Field.
I did not know that the doming of Soldier Field was a big part of this. Am I missing something here?
Brandon's right. That's what the issue is.
But I thought the issue was that they can't do that, that it's just not economically feasible.
Right. This sort of has its roots in the 2001 deal that Mayor Richard M. Daley reached with the Bears, which saw the toilet bowl or spaceship, however you want to put it, put inside the colonnades of Soldier Field. So essentially, that was what the Bears demanded to sign on for a lease that expires in 2033. And the issue is that was at best, I think everybody agrees, a stopgap measure. Because the Soldier Field only has 62,000 seats, which is the least amount of any NFL stadium, which means a couple of things. One, that the Bears' revenue upsides are limited. And two, they're limited even more because they don't own the physical structure. The city owns the physical structure, which means that they can't do what they want to do, like put a sports book in there. I imagine that the Bears looked at what happened with the Lucas Museum fight and said, oh man, there's no way that anybody at Chicago is letting us do anything more significant to Soldier Field than we have already done. So if we want more seats or more control, we have to go elsewhere. And I think that was somewhat complicated by Mayor Lightfoot's reaction back in June, which basically said, shut up and start winning games against the Packers. And today we learned that the Bears were scheduled to have a meeting with Mayor Lightfoot and her team yesterday. They canceled that. And then they had George McCaskey call the mayor and say, look, we're about to announce that we've reached a purchase agreement on the Arlington Heights land. But I don't think we should overlook the fact that if this deal to buy the racetrack in Arlington Heights is completed, and would be completed in late 2022 or early 2023, for those of you playing along at home, the next municipal election in which Lightfoot is assumed to be seeking a second term in office is February of 2023. So that means that this is going to be in the headlines every day, as she asks voters for a second term.
Do you think it will redound negatively to Mayor Lightfoot's reelection chances that she, quote unquote, lost the Bears?
Part of Lightfoot's appeal was that she was sort of a Chicagoan who rooted for the Bears, who had season tickets at the 50-yard line, who could talk about the need for a quarterback. I think that is complicated, that sort of appeal is complicated when we hear her say things like she did today, that, you know, if the Bears leave, well, life goes on.
Right. Yeah. It could be an emotional issue, but also there's also the emotional resonance of the mayor saying, we are not going to give away the store here. You guys want, extra X number of seats. You want a dome. You want this. No, we're not going to fund that for you. Bye-bye. Brandon Pope votes too, you know. So,
and it helps that they suck. That helps the mayor a lot.
Yeah.
In terms of this discussion, but no, I think not only do they not have a lot of leeway within their own stadium, and I think why the city shouldn't blame Lightfoot for this. And I think this is a very smart decision. And I hope and pray that no taxpayer money is devoted to keeping them there, is the fact that if you're a modern sports franchise, you need to have this surround sound, all encompassing experience in the land around the stadium. That's how Wrigley, the new generation of Wrigley is being built. Same with Busch Stadium in St. Louis, SoFi, which Brandon mentioned. You need control of the fan experience around the stadium. And right now at Soldier Field, that is a massive parking lot and then a lake, which you can't really do very much with, which I think is good for the city. It's not the right fit for a professional modern football franchise. You get a lot more flexibility in Arlington Heights. And I think on paper, it's a great move for the Bears, and the city should not bend over backwards to keep the franchise in that building.
It's still a good place for a game. You just have to, it's just not great for the Bears right now. That's really what it comes down to.
Brandon, did you see what the naming rights went for where the Rams are going to play? Did you see what they are going to get for the naming rights to the stadium where the Rams are going to play? It's $500 million.
So far?
Yeah, $500 million. It's $500 million over 20-30 years, but wow. I mean, you just talk about revenue streams, and then the casino, and then, you know, all of the other things that they could control if they moved to Arlington Heights. And, you know, we talk about this in terms of Mayor Lori Lightfoot and the city of Chicago and Chicagoans, and will they vote for or against her because she let the Bears get away? But if you frame it in terms of Bears fans, there's more Bears fans outside the city than there are living in the city. You know what I'm hearing from is Bears fans are like, hey, I live closer to Arlington Heights. It's going to be a lot easier to get there. So maybe they don't care about Lori Lightfoot's problems. I think in Bears Nation, this plays pretty well.
Somebody made a joke on Twitter that the, you know, how is Lori Lightfoot going to replicate the game day experience of a bunch of Arlington Heights people coming to Chicago? You know, I think that sentiment, it makes sense. It's a headache to get to Soldier Field if you live in the city. It just is. And so you're hearing some people talk about the White Sox potentially looking at maybe moving out to where Soldier Field is instead. I think that's a bad idea. It's already, you're just making things more difficult. You know, people who are Bears fans, it runs past Chicago. It's across the country. This is a national brand, kind of like the Cubs. So you're going to appeal to a lot of people regardless. Whether it's in Chicago, think about the New York Jets and New York Giants. They're in New Jersey. The Washington football team's in Virginia. You don't have to be in the city of your namesake.
I'm wondering how many NFL franchises are still in the city that they're named for. A lot
that's
of them,
a good question.
For a while. I don't know where the Detroit Lions are playing now, but they certainly were out in the burbs for a while. They destroyed the Superdome, but a lot of these teams play outside of their civic boundaries, and nobody seems to mind.
Yeah.
And I think in the fullness of time, no one's going to care where the Bears play, especially if they keep playing the way they've been playing.
11 NFL teams play outside the city that they are named for, including both Los Angeles teams and both New York teams.
I
think the issue is that a lot of the Bears' mystique that we all grew up on was that they were a different kind of NFL team. They were gritty. They played in the snow. They were working class. They were Dick Butkus, right? But that does not mesh very well with the modern NFL. The modern NFL has sort of left that model behind. They're a family-owned team, but that leases a stadium, which was very much the model 50 years ago and does not exist anywhere else, basically. So the question is if the Bears no longer have that working class Chicago white ethnic root of fandom, what does the franchise become? And I think that the McCaskies and Wade Phillips are like, okay, well, this is our next act. And to do that, they see a new sort of entertainment complex as their best bet. The question becomes is, you know, what happens to people who grew up with an emotional attachment to those sort of gritty Bears? And do they blame Lori Lightfoot? And people on Twitter are responding to me saying, well, you know, she already lost these people with X policy that she did. And I think that people forget that Lori Lightfoot won 75% of the vote in 2019. So she has a long way to fall.
But this does seem like a self-inflicted wound, doesn't it? I mean, between the Park District, the city, and the team, would it not have been in all of their best interest to find a way to accommodate each other and keep the Bears there? But you got all of this bickering and these stupid comments being made.
But Sean, at some point, you're never going to get past that number of 62,000, that the smallest capacity stadium in the NFL. And that goes back to Mayor Daley. Richard M., who approved the stadium, dropped into the colonnades at Soldier Field rather than raising that whole thing and building a brand new stadium, which could have been domed. But the layout of the park where they were trying to rebuild that stadium, they were trying to do both things at once. And that was a huge mistake in retrospect. And they can't undo it. The Sun-Times talked to some prominent architects, including some who were involved in creating that stadium in the first place, and they said that no, you can't really. You can add a few seats in the end zone, but no, you know, that stadium is doomed to be small, and it's too small for the NFL. So if you're going to point the finger of blame at somebody, point it at Rich Daley.
Yeah, and you got to think too. Part of the experience is: are you a intimidating place for a road team to come into? And playing at Soldier Field is no longer intimidating. It's easy to win at Soldier Field, probably one of the easiest stadiums, if not the easiest, to go on the road and beat a team. Not because the fans aren't passionate, just not enough of them. And the way the stadium is built, it's not built for that. The NFL is in a different landscape now than it was in the 80s. It's modernized, and now it's an arms race for the most state-of-the-art stadium you can. Look at what the Cowboys did. Look at what the Rams have done, what Vegas, the Raiders have done. They're making mad money off of these new facilities and the facilities and the businesses that come around those areas. So at this point, yeah, the Bears are way behind. They've been behind, but they got to play catch-up. You got to look at McCaskey's. They're not like most NFL owners. They're family run. They're not as rich as these other owners who have multiple businesses. This is their business.
I'm a little perplexed, Brandon, though, by everybody's rooting for the McCaskies and the loss of 30 or 40,000 seats. I mean, these poor McCaskies, what are they only worth? $1 billion with that franchise tag? I mean, you think they were a mom and pop shop.
I get what you mean. I think most people, their initial reaction is, couldn't the city have done something? Couldn't they have worked with them a little bit more? I think the best example of the city's absolute inability to make entertainment investments is right across the parking lot from Soldier Field, and that's McCormick Place. That is the most square footage of convention center space in the Western Hemisphere. It loses money every single year. Every decade or so, we get a whole new economic impact study about how great it would be to dump in a whole new wing or a publicly funded hotel. And all this city leaders and business leaders go behind closed doors to make those deals. And Chicago loses every single time. And I think we would go through this protracted dance of the exact same thing with Soldier Field if we were to just, you know, keep negotiating.
Brandon likes it. Austin likes them moving to Arlington Heights.
Although I will qualify, if Arlington Heights starts like eminent domaining and bulldozing homes or gives them a ton of money or takes out a ton of debt like Bridgeview did, I always get Bridgeport and Bridgeview mixed up, that would change my opinion.
Hey, Eric, I wonder if it's going to be a case to be careful what you ask for. Like, you know, they are going to have more traffic and infrastructure issues, and it's already kind of a built-up area. Arlington Heights isn't the south side, so, you know, it'll be interesting to see if this is all that it promises to be.
Yeah, well, my former colleague Steve Chapman had a really good column on this just recently, and where he talked about it. When cities go for these stadium deals, they don't end up being very, they often get fleeced. They don't end up being very good deals for the city. The teams make out like bandits, but the cities would do all kinds of all their infrastructure improvements, and they put their TIF money and other monies into building the stadium, and then they end up not doing so well on it. So it's something for Arlington Heights to be careful of. For sure.
I'm not a Chicagoan originally, right? So I'm just kind of rooting for chaos. I heard this idea of the Jacksonville Jaguars moving to Chicago, becoming the Chicago Jaguars in this scenario and taking over Soldier Field. It's weird. I love it. give me weirdness. All for it.
What do you care? You're not the mayor. So just what the hell? Bring it.
Brandon Pope, I am pro chaos. That's the tagline for 2023.
Well, you know, just what a great platform to run on. Just one last thing about this, then I want to move on to another thing. But what did you say, Heather? 75% of the votes came in for Lori Lightfoot. Yeah. I'll bet she doesn't get that now. I'll bet she doesn't get 75% now.
She won't.
It would be shocking if she did.
If I can paraphrase you, Heather, it depends on who you can't right. beat someone with no one. And you've got it depends on who she's running against. Right. I mean, it's easy to say, do you like what she's doing? But then the question is, do you want to change horses, so to speak, and give somebody else a chance? That's a big question for Chicagoans that the voters are going to face in 2 years now.
No. Speaking of Chicago, parking in Chicago can be done, but not always easily. City Clerk Anna Valencia is getting pressure from Alderman Ray Lopez to eliminate our zoned residential parking system in favor of a citywide parking sticker. The cost of the sticker would depend on how many cars you own, according to him. Plenty of us who have paid for stickers for our respective zones still have trouble finding a spot on our streets. I'm not sure how a city-wide sticker fixes that. Heather, what's the strategy there? How does this alleviate that?
Well, the idea is that it is a pain in the rear end for a lot of people who live in residential parking zones to go get the sticker and then get, you know, guest passes for when they have people to come over their house and get those and put them in the window and avoid a ticket. And the idea is that if you basically open up parking to everybody, but charge everybody a little bit more, the system will be easier to administer. You'll take in more money and people will be less angry because they won't get a ticket and their friends won't get a ticket. This is, I want to be charitable about my, colleagues and competitors who have written about this story, but there was a reason I didn't write about it. There is no possible scenario in which aldermen vote to take parking rights away from their residents who will go to the polls to elect them or not in 2023. This is a coveted perk for especially people who own million-dollar homes in Lincoln Park. To get that residential parking permit is not easy. You have to sort of petition and, go through a whole, hoops process. So there might be some sort of, theoretical good government argument for it. But the fact of the matter is that while the aldermen hate administering this program, they love that it exists because it means that they don't get calls from people saying, I can't park out in front of my house. What are you, Alderman Joe Schmo, going to do about it?
How much power, though, does a given alderman have over those actual stickers? Is it more that people expect them to deal with it when they have complaints? The aldermen themselves don't have any actual administrative power over, selling tickets, do they?
They do.
Selling the stickers,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, they do. Okay. So 7 aldermen actually have the equipment in their offices to sell the permits.
Oh my God.
It is a way for aldermen to make contact with people who live in the ward.
But you could get it at City Hall. You just go down to, I went down to City Hall yesterday and got a sticker, right?
Yeah, you can do it. You can either do it through City Hall or you can do it through the alderman's office.
But only 7 of them.
Right, but only 7 of them do it. Now, this is because you need specialized equipment and you have to pay for that specialized equipment out of your aldermanic.
They should be at the Jewels. They should have those thing at the Jewels. You just like you get all kinds of the little serve. I mean, seriously, why can't you just go to your local grocery store or post office and say, hey, I need a sticker?
You used to be able to do this, and there was a big problem with counterfeit stickers.
This program started back in 1979, and it was up around Northeastern University where there was, an influx of people parking there, and they came upon this as a way to alleviate the parking shortage up there. And it has spread now to 2,000 communities or 2,000 little areas in the city. And at the time that it started, it was a bad idea, I think, except in those rare situations where when you're living somewhere, then suddenly circumstances change. A new school comes in, a new huge apartment building comes in, and it actually changes the whole dynamics of parking in the neighborhood. I'm an opponent of these. My wife and I sort of fought back successfully against an effort to have it on our street on the northwest side. But I'm also right now, I would have to say I'm an opponent of yanking it back from a lot of people. You talk about wealthy people who bought houses in areas where they thought, well, one of the advantages to living here is I will have a sticker, I'll be able to park. And it adds to the value of their property. And suddenly to take that away from them is, I don't even think it's fair at this point to do that. And Heather's completely right that these influential, wealthy people are going to scream like hell if you try to take this their parking away from them. And it's not just influential, wealthy people. There are other neighborhoods that are around train stations and so on, L stops, where parking is very rare, or there are places that are around business districts out closer to the edge of the city where the parking gets very closed off, say on weekends and nights and so on. And people are going to be really upset about that. So there's no chance this is going to happen. But it does sort of reignite the debate about who owns the streets? Who owns those parking places? Just because you live there doesn't mean you own the spot in front of your house. Those are our streets, right?
I'm just so happy times like this to be a carless Chicagoan, because it's such a headache. And this is why I gave up having a car in Chicago, trying to find parking, dealing with residential parking. Sometimes you have residential parking and there's still no place to park. There's still no places in your area. So it's definitely a headache, but I think it's not going to change. Like, as Heather was pointing out, it's going to, these aldermen, they're not going to remove this and create this problem for themselves and ruin the re-election chances. So it's one of those headaches of living in Chicago and driving that it's for now, it's going to stay that way.
Before Heather told me that there are 7 aldermen with printing machines for parking stickers, I didn't care that much about this. Now I care about it a lot. I didn't care about it for a long time because I have a rare covered parking space in Lincoln Park. And then weird, due to some administrative loophole, there's like a misplaced sign that gives me like a secret guest little spot. which I will tell you guys about if you ever come to the neighborhood. So I haven't cared too much about sticker politics. The fact that there are elected officials administering those is crazy. That should stop. It should just be a centralized city function. I think you also need to get away from the notion that because you're a property owner, you get a right to, like, imagine if I, just because I owned a multi-million-dollar home in Lincoln Park, got to put like a TV and a bunch of chairs on the street. There's this weird thing that happens when people think like, oh, just like, you definitely need a place for your car. Well, like, that's why we built garages. Like, we have these alleys. Chicago actually has all this, this advantage of our like street and alley system. There's tons of garages. And one thing that jumped out at me in this article was Alderman Ray Lopez saying the problem is exacerbated by the growing number of Chicagoans, quote, using their garages for other things, whether it's their man cave, whether it's storage, whether it's an illegal business. You should make it easier for people to build places to put their cars. And I think if you price that effectively, that's good. Otherwise, you end up in this weird situation where, like, to Eric's point, like, I have to worry about the parking needs of really, really wealthy people who are using a public street to park their car. Let's build homes that are, you know, can accommodate that instead.
Yeah, but in the meantime, those of us who, there's no garage for my four flat or the one next to it or the one next to it. So where are we supposed to park, Austin? There's not going to be any garages for us. We got to park on the street, and it's hard to find a spot on the street.
I think what you'd see if this changed is a lot more apps and applications, like in real life, for private parking. So whether that's a parking garage or whether that's an app for where to find spots that are paid in some way, I think there would be solutions. If people want to own a car, I think there would be cost-effective solutions to be able to do that. Right now, it's a very odd political system, I think.
I got a call from somebody that was going to come into the city for a four-day weekend last weekend, and they were asking me about my advice, and I said, well, good luck finding public transportation. I mean, I wasn't talking about the CTA, but cabs and ride shares are expensive, slow, and sometimes non-existent. They were in the town for 4 days, a couple from Iowa, a couple from Tennessee, senior citizens, it sounded like, and they went everywhere on the buses. They got an app. And they did the CTA buses and loved it. And I'm glad, because I think they'd still be standing on some of these corners looking at their phone or hoping that a cab comes along, right?
Ride shares are ridiculous. It's a mess. I came here thinking, you know, it was going to be easy, a breeze, don't have to have a car. And for the first time since this pandemic, I'm like, yo, maybe it would be easier if I had one with all these expensive prices with Ubers and Lyft.
Yeah, well, it wasn't like that beforehand. And, you know, Brandon, my son, when he came to Chicago, we gave him a car that we owned and we didn't have payments on. We said, here, you just take this car and that'll be your car in the city. And after several months, he said, would you guys take it back? It's too much of a hassle to park and I'm doing nothing but getting. So while he didn't have car payments, he did. They were tickets. That was the car payment in the city of Chicago. Just trying to find a place to park that it's lapsed. You're in a zone you're not supposed to be in. It was a mess. So he just gave the car back.
It's a problem.
And then sometimes you know full well you're not supposed to park there, but you do. That's the number one cause. Last week, Eric reminded us that more police are dying from COVID than from shootings and vehicle crashes combined in the line of duty. In fact, the former head of the Chicago Fraternal Order of Police is in ICU with COVID, and his son won't say if he was vaxxed. And that's where I'm going with this. Six Naperville firefighters are suing the governor, a hospital, and their city, Naperville, over the COVID vax mandate. They say it's unconstitutional and that they resent that. I doubt their argument is all that academic, that they care about the constitutionality of JB's mandates. They just don't want to get vaxxed. But what's your thought, Austin, about this suit? And do you stand with them at least in its, regardless of the wisdom of the vaccine, its overreach by the governor?
Well, I think with cases like this, and I've said on this show before, there are certain classes of workers who are publicly employed who there's a huge public safety interest in having vaccinated. So that would include things like corrections workers, perhaps some social workers, people in like these really close sort of congregate settings, right? And I think it probably should be within the realm of state and local governments' powers to make sure that those people are vaccinated or being tested frequently, because that really affects a very large amount of like your day-to-day operations as a state and local government body. I am not totally convinced that firefighters as a class of workers are necessarily in that category. I haven't read the details of the lawsuit, and I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I would also say that for those who are in favor of that mandate, these sorts of suits, I think, would be fewer and far between and tossed out more quickly if there could be any kind of legislative action on any kind of COVID policy, which there has been none of in 18 months in Illinois, and there probably won't be. But I think these things, this is the risk you run with executive orders, is it can be very difficult to defend in court. I'm not sure about the merits of this suit, but I think it opens the door.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. In fact, the legislature in Illinois has not given us any guidance about how these things should be governed, huh?
No, not just this, like just broad COVID policy, anything from business shutdowns to schools to, it's all been done through rulemaking and executive order rather than through our representative government.
I think you might make the case that firefighters, especially ones that live in firehouses for extended periods of time that are on for 24 hours, are in such close contact with one another that it is inevitable that they will spread COVID if they are not vaccinated and properly masked and so on. I could see making a case for firefighters. Maybe on some case-by-case basis, but I think it's increasingly important that we get people vaccinated and that we compel them to be vaccinated if they're not going to do it. And I don't have a problem with it. I really don't anymore. I think especially public employees, make them get vaccinated. And this it'll help with the immunity. It'll help with the spread. And we're having these situations around the country where people can't get treated in hospitals for other conditions because the hospitals are slammed with COVID patients.
Yeah.
It's a disgrace.
Well, that's where I thought you'd be, Eric. I mean, forget about how close contact they come with other people in the line of duty. They're working for a company that has more than 100 employees. I don't care if you don't like it. You're vaxxed or you're out. I'm not interested in arguing the details anymore.
I'm really disappointed in LeBron James.
Yeah.
Who he's a leader in so many ways. And so a lot of people look up to him and what he says. And his statement after he got the vaccine was like, everyone's got their own choice to do what they want. And I thought it was best for me, but I'm not going to tell other people what to do. I really wish he had come out much more strongly on that.
He used the word research, which is a buzzword now for, I don't know what research means anymore, but you're right. He could have just said, go get the vaccine. He didn't. And by the way, he eventually got vaccinated and said, you should get vaccinated. But it was such a wishy-washy statement that I think it didn't have much import or impact.
Yeah, you know, as president of the LeBron James fan club, I was disappointed by his statements there. But at least at the bare minimum, he was the first person that I've ever heard say they did their own research and actually got the vaccine. Usually it's the opposite. So yeah, did their own research.
Finally, research paid off. Woo, woo.
The vaccine mandates, the mandates work. I mean, there was a great report in the Washington Post that like analyzed all these different companies, health systems, and everything that are imposing vaccine mandates, and it's effective. Like United Airlines, they had a vaccine mandate recently, and they had like I think 25% of their crew was not vaccinated. Now over 96% is vaccinated. You know, in medical systems, they saw in Massachusetts same thing. So they work. People say they're going to quit. Surveys show they are not. because you got to make a living. And it's a shot. And you got a shot in kindergarten to go to kindergarten. You got a shot to play sports. You got a shot for a lot of things. This is just another shot.
Does anybody know what the policy is if you lose your job because you won't get vaccinated? Are you allowed to collect unemployment? Is that considered to be a fireable offense? Then you can't collect unemployment or what?
I think it's probably untested labor law area because we've never really in America had mandates like this.
For some reason, Eric, that has me thinking about how many people are going back to work generally these days. I was at the Walcott Tap on Monroe and Walcott last night with my son having a burger and a beer. Place was packed inside and outside. Two people were working the whole joint. There was a bartender who did the entire bar and the entire interior area. And then there was one wait guy who was aerobicizing the rest of the joint. And the two of them were getting it done. But it's just another reminder of how many people aren't going back to work. I don't know when that's going to happen. I don't know how that's going to happen. The unemployment supplement has run out on people. A lot of those funds are gone now. I don't know what those people are doing or if they're waiting for $16 an hour. I don't know what it is. But I don't know if you guys have noticed it. It continues to be a real problem for a lot of these smaller businesses.
And I think it's the same. It's connected to rideshare as well. I don't think that's necessarily those companies jacking up prices by themselves. And I think there's a lack of labor supply for those types of jobs, period. So that's affecting people's pocketbooks in a bunch of different ways.
Yeah. And a transition to the food to go kind of model of delivery. That's many people find that they'd rather just do that instead of being an Uber driver or Lyft driver.
The sandwich you're delivering does not tell you about the frustrations of its day.
Yeah.
And more likely, you're going to get a tip more likely if you're doing food than if you're driving me from Water Tower Place at the South Side.
I wanted to volunteer at that bar. I was actually going to say, hey, listen, I'll help. I mean, like, it was sort of like just a civic thing. I should help this poor guy. You don't need to pay me. For the community's good. There's like 100 people waiting for beers there. And then somebody wants a drink with cranberry juice and it's requires ice in a shaker. And I'm like, no, he's just trying to pour 1,000 beers. Leave him alone. And they got it done.
Do you have service experience, John?
No. But, well, I mean, I was a bus boy. Everybody was a waiter, a bus boy once upon a time. But, I mean, I can do this. I know how to work a tap. I could have done that. I could have helped him out.
Help wanted sign. Anybody, if you put it out there, John Williams.
There's two signs when you walk into any place now. Help wanted and mask mandate. And pretty much everybody's ignoring at least one of them.
And they're also offering wages that are higher even than the minimum wage. I've seen $16, $17 an hour just for starting level jobs posted in windows of stores and restaurants around town. So it's the labor shortage is real. And John, you make a good point that the unemployment benefits, the unemployment supplement that was supposed to be keeping people at home ran out in early September. So that should have sent everybody rushing back to the job sites, but it didn't.
Part of the issue is that schooling is just still super tenuous right now, so that it's really difficult for moms, especially because, as we all know, you know, childcare falls on women disproportionately. But I have two kids, one in middle school, one in elementary school, and there is not a day that goes by that I do not get an email saying that somebody at their school has tested positive. And it is literally just a matter of time before one or the both of them has to quarantine because they were a close contact. And I know that I'm holding my breath for vaccines to be approved for kids age 5 to 11. And I tend to think that once those kids can be vaccinated and cases start to drop in schools, I mean, in Chicago, things are looking pretty okay right now. It's obviously anecdotal, John, but the two people you saw working were dudes. I don't think we talk about that connection enough, especially in Chicago, where there were close to 10,000 kids in quarantine in the last couple of weeks.
I was just going to get to that. Do you know what the positivity rate is for CPS? Because it's still actually very low. They talk about the exposure rate, but the number of kids as a percentage of the 300,000+ is still low, right?
It is super low. So the citywide positivity rate is 2.5%, and it is not significantly higher in schools. The problem with sort of schools right now is that the way that the CPS has been doing the quarantine orders is that if anybody tests positive in a class, that whole class has to quarantine.
Well, maybe that's an argument for the hypervigilance then of CPS. In the news, it seems like they're always saying, you know, they always report the number of students and the vitriol of the CTU. And I think that paints the picture as CPS schools are not safe or they're not doing a good enough job. And I just don't think that's a fair characterization.
And Allison Arwady has pushed back on that. And I've actually really appreciated what she said around this. She basically said, hey, I was like everyone else. We assumed that just like the flu, that schools would be a center for massive spread. The data is in. They are not that massive source of spread over and above what we see in the community. And basically a sort of a veiled criticism, like outside people are trying to really use parents' emotions against them and saying that Chicago public schools are extremely unsafe. And I really appreciated that from her.
Yeah, yeah. And it works, too, by the way. It's very easy to ratchet those people up. And boy, the cameras love them. R. Kelly this week was convicted of sexually abusing women and children for decades. on counts including racketeering and violations of the Mann Act, which prohibits the transport of people across straight lines for immoral purposes. Hooray for that. There's a lot to talk about here, including this sidebar. What happened to Bill Cosby? Oh, my gosh. Like, no one asked, and yet he volunteered that R. Kelly never caught a break and got screwed by the justice system. So, never mind.
Well, it feels like justice has been served, but it was delayed by a significant amount of time. And it's really a shame that some of R. Kelly's earlier accusers weren't believed and we didn't get a hold of this before there were many, many other victims. I mean, it's a good resolution, but if you the scope of it, the sweep of it is still tragic. The fact that this was known for a long time. Jim DeRogatis has been reporting on it for, 20 years or so. And only now is he being held to account for it. You can't have any excuse for Bill Cosby. I'm also dismayed that Danny Davis, the Southside congressman, said that when R. Kelly is released, which I'm not sure he ever will be, let's hope he doesn't get released. But if he comes back, he'll deserve a second chance. The Chicagoans will give him a second chance. I hope that's not true. I think that we need to really take this very seriously, that the allegations against him are awful. And I'm glad that we got him finally.
DeRoe has a nice 6-part series in The New Yorker talking about it. Nobody's followed this story more closely than DeRogatis, I would say.
The biggest thing to me was the length. And that case was a really good encapsulation of what's happening to so many cases during COVID. And justice delayed is justice denied. And there's a lot of people waiting for justice in cases for years and years and years that would have previously not taken so long. So good day. Good day for Chicago. Good day for the victims.
I think it was complicated, too, by the fact that people felt that some of these women sort of volunteered to be in R. Kelly's orbit because he was famous and successful. And why are you shaking your head, Brandon?
There's a lot of discussion about that, but the big thing here that can't be ignored is that R. Kelly was like a whole adult 30-year-old man, and he's messing with girls who are 12, 13, 14. So whether they chose to be around him or not, they're 12, 13, or 14. No grown man should be doing that. It's despicable. So as it was said here, this has been long delayed. To see Bill Cosby co-sign, they're building a league of super scum. masters of evil, in a sense. It's disgusting to see. And we still got a Chicago case to do. So there's going to be some more coming down the line. And this is long delay. You talk to any woman who's grown up in Chicago, any black woman who's grown up in Chicago, she probably has an R. Kelly story, which is mind-boggling. She can probably tell you about seeing R. Kelly at McDonald's or at the Water Tower Place Mall. Offering happy meals, talking about mentoring young girls about their music career. This has been a long, well-documented thing for years, and it's about time that justice is served.
Yeah, and just to that point about saying that, well, these young women came to R. Kelly and they were enthralled by him and they wanted to be with him. That could very well be true, but that's like saying when someone is date raped, well, you went out with them. You know, yeah. They signed up for perhaps romantic or even sexual attention from him, those who are of a legal age. But that doesn't then mean that, okay, well, anything he did, all the degrading and coercive things that he did to them afterwards, is in any way excused. And I was a little afraid at one point that the jury might buy that, but because the jury did let him off the first time, right?
Particularly in light of those two women that were interviewed at Trump Tower who were not 12 and 13 years old, and I think people kind of rolled their eyes at the seeming complicity of them. They still wanted to be within his orbit. I'm just talking about why he maybe got away with this thing so long. Boy, I'm sure we all remember the Gail King interview where he was just imploring with Gail to believe him.
And that seems like 10 years ago. That was spring 2019, yeah. I think, when that happened, which is crazy. If you are one of the five people who are waiting on this verdict on whether or not to listen to R. Kelly's music, might I suggest Jeremiah, another Chicago R&B singer, is very good. And it's an easy swap.
Yeah, that's helpful.
that's been the wild thing. People are coming out the water saying, oh, I'm still listening to R. Kelly. I'm not going to cancel R. Kelly. His memory is the step music. Come on, y'all. I have stopped listening to R. Kelly for years now.
Really? Because of that?
Well, I am a proud graduate of Kenwood Academy High School, which is also R. Kelly's, I can't say alma mater because he did not graduate, but he, when I was there, which we've covered was 11 years ago, he was a frequent presence among the high school students, and that he was well known for driving up in fancy cars and squiring young ladies of not consent age away. And, you know, it was something we all warned each other about and, you know, tried to look out for each other. So this whole process for me has been like, yes, yeah, that this has long been a thing. You know, I just I remember seeing R. Kelly with Lady Gaga, like the Grammys or something like that. And this was sort of before that all happened. And I was just like, wow, everybody has just forgotten about this. And I do credit Jim DeRogatis for sort of keeping on. And he, of course, and his reporting partner, Abdin Palash at the Sun-Times really sort of started this ball rolling. But I think it's probably worth taking a minute to realize that one of the women who testified against R. Kelly in his New York case was a 13-year-old girl who met R. Kelly outside his criminal trial at 26th in California, where he was charged with child pornography, and that this girl met him there and was swept up in this awful, horrible world. And, you know, I don't think that there is plenty of blame to go around for how long that this man was allowed to prey on these girls. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of people who were complicit in it, and there are a lot of people who just thought it was in their best interest to look the other way.
Kind of intrigued, Brandon, you didn't answer my question, and I don't think you heard it, but did you stop listening to R. Kelly because of the charges against him or because of his notorious behavior, or had he just fallen out of favor for you?
Oh, it was because of the behavior, because of the allegations. It was tough for me in good conscience, especially after, you know, covering this for one, watching Surviving R. Kelly, the documentary, talking to people who, you know, have accused R. Kelly of these transgressions. It was tough for me to then press play on a song where this man has songs where he's talking about age ain't nothing but a number. He's got incriminating songs. He's got a lot of songs where it's like, it was kind of right there in your face. Aaliyah was 13 years old when he first started talking to her and did this Age Ain't Nothing But a Number album. And the songs he was producing for a young girl right away was a red flag. It's sad that I am sad that I did not kind of get keyed into how problematic R. Kelly was until this bubbled right back up, right? And so for me, that's where I have to hold my head down and think about how we weigh who these artists are and the music they're making and the impact they have on people. So there's a lot of reckoning to do. I think a lot of people are having that discussion and having that whole what is the line, right, between separating the artist from the art, and can you actually do that with someone like R. Kelly?
Well, at least you're not paying for it. If you listen to an R. Kelly song now, I don't know, maybe Spotify records a hit, but you wouldn't be going out and buying an album or a concert ticket. You know, this sort of thing comes up when, I don't know if you want to go back and watch an old Bill Cosby episode or a Harvey Weinstein film, but, you know, there's plenty of conversations about them. What do you do with those people's work now? Because you used to enjoy it. Now you find out they're a monster. Can you still enjoy their craft after the fact? And for you, the answer is no.
Well, that's tough because you just mentioned Bill Cosby there, and I can't stand on this high moral ground because I watched The Cosby Show 2 weeks ago on Amazon Prime.
I haven't. Is that weird? Is that weird? Do you look at him and go, oh, Jesus, you had us fooled then, and you don't have me fooled now, so now I'm looking at you, and you're the worst person ever.
But you also think about the other characters, too. This is an ensemble show. And you think about the memories they brought you. Episode I wanted to watch was the Claire Huxtable featured episode. So, you know, for me, I was watching for Claire Huxtable. Uh-huh. I was watching for Felicia Rashad. You know, it really is. It's a personal decision ultimately, but it's for R. Kelly. That was a line I couldn't cross.
Yeah, no kidding.
Comedian Louis C.K. is also extremely problematic these days. I mean, he's very funny, I think.
He's hilarious.
I enjoyed every one of his specials, and now, and then, of course, they took them off Netflix, and you can't watch them. And I don't know that if I would listen to them, if I could find them right now. It's a little difficult. On the other hand, you do have to note that there are a lot of people in the entertainment business, in the arts, who are very problematic when you scratch the surface, both currently and historically. So it's not an easy decision to make or easy conversation to have all the time. I mean, I think not everyone is as clear-cut a monster as R. Kelly was. R. Kelly seems like almost the definition of a monster. Bill Cosby as well. Yeah. When you got Louis C.K., who's just extremely creepy, he's arguably less of a monster than these other two, but he's still that's still pretty bad. I don't know. Heather, what's your take on
this? I know Heather's got something to say.
I was just going to say that what Louis C.K. has admitted to doing, I think, goes a little bit beyond super creepy. But I got to tell you that the experience of being a woman in the professional world and just the world in general is being somebody who sees monsters everywhere, because there are monsters everywhere. And then you say, hey, look, there's a monster. And men typically look at you as if you've just said, hey, do you see the purple monster behind that person? And of course, they don't see the purple monster, whereas all you can see is the purple monster, you know, standing right
there.
But
what are you saying, Heather? That did you assume that about
him? She was pointing at me.
As we were doing this, her finger
literally on my Zoom
was cast in the direction of
monsters.
Right
in the top right
corner. I should have done that.
Which is now pointing at all of us. But I'm kind of curious about that, Heather. So are you saying you assume maybe the worst may be lurking behind all of us, behind all men, or that...
No, that women are constantly being forced to navigate sort of perilous situations, that in a lot of situations you can explicitly say to somebody else and say, look, I don't feel safe, I don't feel comfortable, I feel threatened, or you're forced to sort of wonder, hey, did that guy mean something different than the most sort of innocuous reading that I'd like to give it? And if I don't, and should I be on my guard? And it's like, it's just that sort of mental emotional labor that's exhausting. And that I think that I don't know how anybody could have lived through the last 5 years of American history and concluded, well, there are fewer monsters than we thought actually out there. Mm-hmm. When I think there's a lot of evidence to show that there are significantly more monsters hiding in plain sight than I think any of us really understand or could cope with sort of like emotionally.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's a different filter than a guy has. That's a different filter.
Exactly. And that's what I'm talking about. Does this guy mean me harm? Mm-hmm. Or is this guy going to let me do my job without sort of talking about my body or my personal life?
And, you know, this is something I'm glad you mentioned this, Heather, because I'm going to do my best to articulate this. With R. Kelly, especially in the Black community, it's hit this sort of striking point, and almost a generational divide. And I think a lot of that is because R. Kelly is a monster we've known, right? There are many men who are like R. Kelly. For a lot of Black women, they've experienced people like R. Kelly in their own family. However, they are raised up and told that the onus is on them as the little girl, that they were being, quote, fast, as it's called. It's a Southern Black expression to say a little girl's being fast, meaning she's being overly, you know, provocative or sexual or something like that. And so that's using an excuse, taking away onus from the man, oftentimes older in these family units, familial units, friend groups, things like that. And it strikes a tone. And for a lot of the older generation, like my mom's generation, my grandma's generation, they grew up in a time where, you know, it was just the nature of a man. This is just what men do. And so we're just going to let it slide, right? And this generation is like, no, we're not going to let that slide. And that's the right thing, right? That's why a lot of the R. Kelly defenders, grew up with R. Kelly's music, but also he is, to them, someone they feel like they should have to defend, because this is what they've done in the past with men in their own lives, men in their own units that, you know, are predators. So it's been really interesting to see that discussion and to see how that plays out, because this really is, it strikes a nerve and it's triggering for a lot of people, because they know R. Kelly. He may not be named Robert, but they know somebody in their family or someone they've been around that is just like that and has been excused, and the onus has been put on the woman and not the man himself.
Brandon's 100% right that a lot of people in my generation and younger are saying, you know what, I'm just not going to put up with this anymore. I'm going to speak out about it. Every woman I have ever met has had some sort of experience where they just sort of bit their tongue and got themselves out of the situation without sort of making it a whole thing. And on one hand, I've done that and I don't fault anybody for doing that. But every time somebody does that, it gets a little bit harder the next time to say something, because you think, well, I put up with it last time. Do I really want to go through this whole thing? Can't I just get back to writing my story, or can't I just get back to writing this report or closing the sale?
Boy, isn't that in part just a little bit the Eric Ferguson story, one of the most successful DJs in town ever. And one of his colleagues said that there was inappropriate behavior on his part for a long time. It was manipulation. It was sexual. And that was on the front page of the Tribune the other day. That's getting big play. He's still employed over at that radio station. They said they did their own investigation and that he did none of these sorts of things. And his attorney is very strident about that. Not a molecule of this is true. And yet the women's allegations also seem plausible. And that's all you know. The damage it does to his career, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen to him. But that image is going to stick. It even feels credible, although we don't know if this lady's just making it up. But to your point, Heather, that sometimes you let something go, and then you let it go, and then you let it go. And she brought it up finally when she got fired. And she said, well, I've been treated unfairly all along.
Well, I would just say that in the case of Eric Ferguson, and I think it's relevant that he's had two female co-hosts that have left under less than clear circumstances. And these were on-air partners that had a significant paycheck and a significant amount of clout and a significant social media following and sort of institutional power. And as far as I know, we've never really gotten a clear answer as to why they departed the show in the way that they did. But it's stuff like that that I think will give the story additional
That's connecting
interest.
The dots, but they didn't say that, you know, but that's us doing it. I mean, it's conceivable that that's not true, that there's no connection between the other women that left. And yet it looks logical, doesn't it? My point is that's almost unfair to Eric Ferguson in a very literal sense.
I will give Eric Ferguson the benefit of the doubt, and I will say that he did nothing of this sort of these allegations with his two co-hosts. However, I do think that people who treat people poorly in one respect will treat other people poorly in other respects. And that says that there's perhaps a larger problem. And as we've seen with R. Kelly and Bill Cosby, these are rarely isolated incidents.
Yeah, my guess is that both of these former co-hosts of his are probably bound by some sort of a settlement or arrangement when they left, not to disparage or to disclose any information about that, but that those restrictions will be lifted if there is a deposition to be held in this. And I think you're going to find out a lot in depositions if this lawsuit goes forward, and it well might not, where these people who are bound by certain ethical constraints or legal constraints will have to come in and tell the story. And then we will find out if this is a pattern. If this is this alleged relationship took place in 2004, and then afterwards he pressured her for a long time, allegedly. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of thing that probably, if it did happen, it probably didn't just happen once, and that there may be many other people that will come forward, or some other people will come forward to tell similar stories or corroborating stories. So I think as Heather says, we should give Eric Ferguson the benefit of the doubt. This is just a lawsuit. Anyone can file a lawsuit about anything.
But you know, where you're left is either this is a person with a vivid imagination and none of this happened, and she only has who knows what her motivation is, but she's decided to throw this out there all these years later. She's finally said, all right, I got fired and I'm angry and I'm going to make up this story about Eric Ferguson. And none of it is true, which is what Eric Ferguson and his attorney are saying, that none of this is true. Another strategy would be something where you would afford her criticism, her complaint, at least some accommodation. Say, well, I know that some of my intentions were misconstrued, but I didn't know anything like that. But yeah, there were instances where she was, give her some leeway there. But to say that none of it, absolutely none of it is true, is also hard to believe, that she's completely fabricated this thing. So I'm sure that the best legal defense is to completely deny everything. But frankly, that strains credulity too to me. I'm like, really? None of this is true? She made all of this up now? I mean, that's hard to imagine as well. Hey, guys, one last thing. WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times are going to merge. Is that in fact going to happen? And what does that do to the media landscape in town?
Well, Robert Feeder, the media blogger who's been on top of this story, says that the WBEZ board is going to meet in a confidential session Wednesday night, the night that we are recording this, to go over this proposed arrangement that's being orchestrated, I guess, by Michael Sachs, who heads the Sun-Times, that Sun-Times is seeking this out. If it happens, I think you're going to see a particularly strong newsroom. I think the Sun-Times newsroom has been doing a pretty good job these days, and BEZ has been doing a pretty good job. You combine those two newsrooms, then you're going to have a much stronger newsroom. It's going to put a challenge into the Tribune and the Alden Global Capital that owns them. They're going to have to, rather than cut, they're going to have to up their game. They're going to have to meet this challenge that will be raised by this new organization.
My first reaction is that I think this sets up the Sun-Times for a much longer existence today than I would have guessed yesterday. I think it creates a pathway for their brand to survive and have a funding mechanism if it were to go through. Whether that means the print edition sticks around, I think, is anyone's guess, but it's a really interesting hedge in the market against Alden. So I think it points the new pathway forward, right? Which is you have reporting organizations with strong brands teaming up with like a publicly funded 501c3, and they can survive that way in some form.
Would it ideally have been with the Tribune? I mean, that's been the paper of record traditionally in Chicago, right? You know, sometimes it's always the scrappy. They were the White Sox, too, the Chicago Tribune's Cubs. Would that have been a more logical play, or maybe that wasn't an option, Austin? Do you have any insight on that?
I have no idea if they spoke. I mean, I think it may have to do. Sachs has relationships with all different parts of Chicago, probably doesn't have relationships as much with like an Alden. I think it would make more sense with those more local brands like a BEZ, which is tied in with the philanthropic community.
My thought is organize your newsrooms, y'all.
You don't think that you don't share Eric's optimism for robust journalism here?
So I think whenever you have consolidations of two news organizations, there's the potential for job losses, and there is a reduction in the number of viewpoints. So, you know, the way WBEZ covers City Hall is the different than the way I cover City Hall at WTTW, and it's different than the Tribune and the Sun-Times. And I think if you combine WBEZ and Chicago Sun-Times, even under the best circumstances, you will be losing another viewpoint. And I think that is not something to be celebrated.
I'm not sure that's necessarily true if you're going to save one or both of them. I mean, there's a reason why they're merging, and it might be that the Sun-Times long-term financial future is not that bright, and they feel like if they can consolidate, they can both survive. And there are lots of cities around the country where they have to go into joint operating agreements to save their newspapers. And that has, I mean, it's not ideal, obviously, when any one of these organizations has financial difficulties or are suffering from a poor financial outlook. But it does remain possible. I'm still optimistic that this is something that will benefit news consumers and will result in a stronger newsroom of the combined organization.
Kind of that's like what I ultimately hope for. I wanted to serve the audience. You know, I love WBEZ. I love listening to WBEZ, and I love what the Sun-Times does. They're different. I mean, Heather, you hit that pretty well. I just hope they can keep their same respective style, brand, and their people. And oftentimes, you know, when consolidation happens and job loss happens, oftentimes it's people of color that are journalists that often get the squeeze first. So I optimistically want this to be good for Chicago. I want this to be good for both sides. But it came out of left field. And I think WBEZ doesn't really need this as much as the Sun-Times does. But if it helps keep the Sun-Times up and running and maintains jobs, I'm all for it.
By the way, one last thing, Brandon. Somebody said, will Justin Fields still be the quarterback of the Bears when they finally go to Arlington Heights? What's your answer to that?
Let's see who's coaching him.
It won't be Matt Nagy. I'm sure about that.
Yeah. Well, Nagy might be fired after Sunday if they lose to the Lions. So right. I'll be objective about it.
That wraps it up. That's Brandon Pope. You also heard Heather Sharon, Austin Berg, Eric Zorn. Thanks for dialing in. I'm John Williams. Maybe we'll see you on stage in a few weeks. We're produced by Ashley Byhun and Elif Garris. We'll drop into the podcast on you next week. Thank you, campers.
All right, y'all. I'll catch you later.
You guys soon.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.